Every business wants good customer reviews. Every customer wants a good experience. So what happens when both sides click? Or in some cases, when they don't? From Yelp and Entrepreneur Media, this is Behind the Review. I'm Emily Washkovic, Yelp small business expert. Behind the Review features conversations with business owners and customers who wrote one of their Yelp reviews. In our discussions, we talk about lessons they've learned that can be used by other businesses to improve their own reviews or their bottom line. This week, I'm catching up with Matthew Wong, owner of Tea and Milk, a bubble tea spot in New York that opened its first location in a 10 by 10 foot space at the Long Island Flea Market back in 2013. Since our first conversation in 2021, Tea and Milk has expanded to three locations, tripled the space of their Astoria location, and now has catering options for weddings or events. In addition to all that, Matthew has worked to build Tea and Milk into a real brand, not just a few storefronts. Like almost all expansion and growth, it wasn't without its growing pains.
We expanded to our third location in Bay Ridge in Brooklyn. And that was quite a tough one. I wouldn't say tough. I would say it was a little bit more on the learning curve, especially since we had to build out a full kitchen.
That's what you and I were talking about briefly last time, was just this whole learning experience. Even though you've done the concept, it's way different when you're starting from scratch versus those other spots that you moved into. You adapted them to what you needed, right?
The Astoria in itself is full electric. Chelsea Market, full electric. No gas, nothing like that. And then we saw the opportunity for growth during that time. And the only way to grow is to have a centralized kitchen to create new recipes, to basically cook the ingredients because our ingredients are cooked fresh. So we had to cook the ingredients ahead of time and deliver it. And that was the only way to grow. So we can grow our brand to even like smaller locations or medium-sized locations, just because it'll help the process of even in the near future, maybe franchising or something like that.
That was a big strategic decision for you. And you knew it wasn't going to be easy. I mean, you knew it was going to be a headache, but you encountered some things that popped up along the way, as it always does, right? When you're remodeling something. Remind me, though, the estimated length, did it double?
Oh, it tripled, actually. We tripled our space in Astoria, but we cut a third of it to become the centralized kitchen. Two-thirds of it is it's our counter space and then seating. We have about maybe, I don't think I've ever counted, but I think we have about 25 to 30 seats in Bay Ridge, including benches for people to hang out and just drink boba and talk.
It's all rushing back to me, our first interview about how your friends, you guys would sit around. And so you had that desire, I remember, for it to be that type of space. But that sounds like a lot of seating to me. Is that because you have seen people in the other locations, like, hang around and actually have that community in your space?
Absolutely. I think in Astoria, before COVID, we had it opened. And we only have 10 seats, and there's usually groups of friends who want to come in and just sit down. And we didn't have enough seats for them to sit down and talk or for multiple groups. But it's kind of like a full circle, going back into a full circle. As in the beginning, when we first started the business, we were sitting together as a group of friends and talking about what we can do to create our own brand, to just talk about our daily struggles in our 9-to-5. And then now we're creating a space where everyone now can do that in Bay Ridge. We are a brand that specializes in bubble tea that are made with real ingredients with integrity, quality ingredients. We don't utilize any powders except for matcha and cocoa powder. We don't use anything that are artificial, such as your popping boba that has juices that are made with artificial juices, fruit juices. We basically now grew into a brand that umbrellas a Vietnamese sandwich concept as well.
How did I forget about the sandwich concept, Matt? You are in a transition right now. When you were introing yourself, you said we're a business, and then you said we're a brand, because you are a brand, right? Yeah. But that's been an evolution for you. From that first goal, which was to have this brick and mortar store with these amazing ingredients and to teach people what real boba is, mm-hmm. to now wanting to be known as a brand and a company that has things under its umbrella. Talk to me about that shift, because I think a lot of entrepreneurs dream of that. That's end game. But to get there, it's quite a bit of work. Can you talk about that transition and kind of why you moved from we're a boba shop to we're a brand that encompasses these different businesses?
Yeah, absolutely. So the reason why we exclaim that, or even say that we're a brand versus a shop, is because partially is the trust from the customers. When you're a shop, you have these customers come into your shop and they put their trust into your drinks, your offerings. But as a brand, everyone who hears about your brand should know who you are already. When they hear about you, they use a couple of words to describe you. And one of which is a brand that's trustworthy, a brand that is fun, and something like that we want to be affiliated with is the integrity part of it. So the reason why our brand is a little different from other companies or brands is because although we have Vietnamese sandwiches and we also work with other brands like City Cakes, which sadly is now closed, but it's because we all have that same quality of using high quality ingredients. Vietnamese sandwiches are made with high quality ingredients as well. They're not made with ingredients that are just the ends of the, let's just say, for example, the barbecue pork. It's not made with the ends of the pork. It's made with premium ground pork. So I think as a brand versus a shop, a brand basically umbrellas all the qualities of what these shops are supposed to adhere to.
There's this element of consistency, which you guys have been focused on that from the start. But I think that's also really associated with a brand, right? It's going to be the same way, those high quality ingredients all the time. I know when we did our first interview, you talked about what a challenge it is for you to source all those ingredients, but it's still the North Star and you're never going to deviate from that. Can you just tell a little bit about that again for maybe people who haven't listened to our first episode yet? Why is consistency so important to you, and what have been some of those challenges, but in the long run, payoffs of sourcing high quality ingredients, really going the extra mile to stand by your mission and not really cut corners when it comes to sourcing your product?
So the reason why from the beginning, we've always sourced our product from its sources, right? Basically, Taiwan for oolong tea, China for jasmine tea. We also go to Japan for matcha. Everything basically is what we're getting it from, straight from the source, and not necessarily from third parties or the companies that will help you source, but at the same time, not know who they're sourcing from. And the reason why we do that is because we want to know where everything is coming from. We want to know everything that goes into the drink. We want to know that a certain tea leaf, certain like oolong tea versus jasmine tea versus the black tea that we use, they're all coming from the right regions, the right places. And we believe in that type of integrity from our, especially like farmers who are the ones who are doing the farming the tea leaves. We want to make sure that we're all in that same kind of essence of quality. This is the reason why we don't deviate from our route into other sources. In the beginning, we had a lot of people who doubted us, who were telling us that, I think this is probably from the first episode, we talked about how certain suppliers, wholesalers, were just doubting the fact that using natural ingredients, using real ingredients, would cut into cost. It will cut into your, I guess, your revenue stream and your profits, but and you will never make it. But lo and behold, I guess we're here. Let's just say we still use taro, for real taro for a taro milk tea since the very beginning, about, what, like 10 years now? It's almost a decade, yeah. And we haven't deviated from that same recipe since, and it's been working really well, I'm very glad to say. And that's basically part of the reason why we don't want to deviate from it. It's like things that we believe in are working. We're going to just build and improve on that versus deviating and becoming a lesser brand. Partially, it's the trust. We've built the trust since 10 years ago. We're not going to try and lose the trust of our customers now because prices went up. Granted, don't get me wrong, the costs of goods have gone up so high that it is cutting into our profits. But at the same time, we're going to continue on doing what we're doing because we believe in the quality of ingredients that the brand is supposed to hold.
Yeah, and I knew from the first time I interviewed you that you are such a like business-minded person. This food and these real ingredients from these places that are often imitated with fake ingredients, that is so important to you. But you're also a numbers guy. You're not just gonna get the best ingredient and then, like you said, it cuts into your profits when prices go up, but you're very aware of what it costs you to make a drink and what someone pays for it. But in food, I mean, in restaurants even people who sell alcohol, those margins are just horribly thin. When we're talking about boba tea, I mean, it's ridiculous. Can you just give some advice on why you have to look at the numbers? I'll be honest, Matthew, a lot of business owners don't look at their P&L at all. Like they don't pay attention to any of the numbers. And I think it's because they're afraid of what the margins finally are, or maybe they don't even know how to look at it all and make sense of things. But you've had to do it and you've done it really effectively. Can you just talk about how you navigate that process?
So my background is in accounting because of the 9-to-5 that I used to do. I used to do accounting for a law firm. And we look at the P&L, the balance sheet all the time. And there's always a partner who always complains about the amount of profit that the firm is getting compared to what he thinks other firms are getting. And I totally understand that from his point of view now. Back then, I was just like, this guy keeps complaining for some reason. But now it's like, hey, like I can see why people are worried about the bottom line. And it's one of those basic things that each entrepreneur and each business owner should definitely learn to read. It's like one of the five basic things that you have to know in order to have a successful business. If not, it'll pull you back from expanding or pull you back from the business itself. Reading the P&L and balance sheet, things of all that nature is very stressful and it's very scary to read. And in the beginning, I definitely didn't want to read it. I definitely gave it to one of my partners to read and everyone was just negative on it, right? And I totally get it. In the beginning, we were not profiting well. We were not profiting at all. We were always at a loss and we were just like stressed about it. But a big portion of it was to keep going and build our brand. There's always that fine line of continuing on building your brand or closing things down, right? We kept pushing to build that brand because we saw that the P&L wasn't looking good. The balance sheet wasn't looking good. And at the same time, we also thought about the ramp-up period. There's always that ramp-up period, the education to the customers that are around the area. So if certain parts of your business isn't doing well because, and then you're reading your P&L and it's scaring you, it's very likely because you're not doing something that you need to do, such as marketing, such as education to the customers, such as training your staff, things like that. There's all these things that cuts into the P&L, cuts into your balance sheet, cuts into every single financial statement that you're supposed to read. And you just need to have that process, your SOPs, standard operating procedures to be there in order to push forward. There's no other way around it.
And I mean, you and your friends, your business partners,
they're friends too.
I mean, well, I was going to say, I remember that being a big part of the original story. It's not easy to go into business with anyone, let alone with your friends, but you all have really leaned on each other's best traits in the process. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs say it's lonely in entrepreneurship because I'm at the top, but you have this built-in network of other entrepreneurs. Can you maybe just talk about the benefit and value of throwing your ideas off your other business partners, and also maybe any challenges that you navigate, or like advice for people who are looking to really trust someone else in talking about that kind of thing for their business?
So in the beginning, it was me and two other friends of mine who are now not with the company anymore. Back then, we did bounce off ideas of each other. And there's always going to be the times where you're going to argue about something. Not even argue, like, you know, just have a conversation about something that gets heated. There's always going to be that time where, like, people don't agree and everyone feels like, oh, the other entrepreneurs, other friends, partners are coming up against one other entrepreneur or things like that. But in the end of the day, you just have to understand, you have to be very open to it, to these conversations. Right now, it's me, myself, and Mike, who are the sole owners of Tea and Milk. And then there's Jennifer, who is our general manager, who manages all three locations. We have a WhatsApp chat. We talk about every single little thing that either goes wrong or things that we believe needs to be changed and ideas, things like that, to make sure that we actually are on the same page. I speak to a lot of other entrepreneurs. One person I really speak to is Eddie from Miles Bounds. And we talk about ideas. We talk about collaborations. We talk about all these things that are going wrong in our businesses and how to fix it. We give each other suggestions. You just have to find the right person to talk to. Whereas if I talk to someone else, they could just brush you off or whatnot. The type of people who wants to be in your ecosystem will always be there. The type of people who don't care to be, you'll know. You can definitely tell.
Absolutely.
It's not really like, I think it's just one of those things that you just have to have trustworthy people in your team. And I, very luckily, have the right people in my team.
We're going to take a quick break. Be right back.
Hi, I'm Robert Tuckman, and I host Entrepreneurs How Success Happens podcast. Each show, I get to interview a successful entrepreneur. Many have built some of the biggest brands in the world, like Lululemon, Warby Parker, Patron, and Drybar. But here's the part I love, because after doing hundreds of episodes, I've noticed regardless of one's success, we rarely get to hear about all of the challenges they faced and overcame to get there. They all had to pick themselves up off the mat at one time or another. I love hearing their stories and how these people we find incredibly successful today are really just like you and me. They all faced difficulties, but they all kept going and got through them. On How Success Happens, we dive deep to find out how they overcame these issues and what was it that drove each of them to keep going and never quit. Because let me tell you, they all faced difficult times. It's a great podcast if you want to learn from the best while inspiring yourself.
Okay, let's talk about expansion. That was the original impetus for us talking again. It feels like not that long ago that you were on the show, but God, the amount of stuff you've done since then is insane. Talk to me about the third location expansion and give some of that color and context around this operational shift. It's not just we opened a brick and mortar. It's this whole shift of how you run all three of them now.
So we opened our third location in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn in July. Grand opening was in July, but we've had the space since early January or so, and we didn't know anything. Building out the space with gas, kitchen, with a hood, all these things were new to us, and we basically went in blind, And it was such a big learning curve that there were times where I wanted to throw in the towel. I don't want to do this anymore, things like that. I can't do this. I just can't. I had a lot of doubts in myself during the whole build-out period. There were things that were supposed to cost X amount of money. And it cost maybe 3X, 2X, 4X. And then I'm just like, where are we getting all this money to pay for this? What about our operating money? How about the other locations? How am I supposed to pay XYZ, these vendors, and then build out vendors versus the vendors who are supplying us, things like that, right? So much work and so different from opening up a shop that is just basically just all electric. And again, this is one thing that we needed to do to expand. And it's because we needed a centralized kitchen to expand. Number one thing was for consistency. And the second thing was to just basically make it easier for the other locations so that they don't have to stress out about cutting taro, cutting 90 pounds of taro per week or whatnot. They can focus on making the drink in itself. As for the other parts of this Bay Ridge location, another reason was because we wanted to expand our offerings, which was the Vietnamese sandwiches. This was a big offering that we used to have in Astoria in the very beginning, like 2015, 2016 maybe. There was a high demand for it, but we couldn't keep up with demand. So we had to cut it for about 5-6 years. That was hard because you saw something that was generating money, but at the same time, you had to cut it because you couldn't keep up with demand. In all honesty, in the beginning, we were getting the Vietnamese sandwiches from a friend who was working out of the kitchen, which obviously we're not going to talk about DOH, but you know, we're going to leave it as that. Everything I'm saying now, honestly, I don't really mind telling, especially that part too, only because that was the very beginning. It's like the struggle.
Years
right?
ago.
Everyone has gone through something in the beginning that they may or may not have been approved. But at the same time, it's like, hey, it worked and it kept working until it didn't work. So now, which is why we had to open up the Bay Ridge location as a centralized kitchen and to deliver from that kitchen to our other locations, which has the bubble tea ingredients, which is all made in-house. And at the same time, the Vietnamese sandwich ingredients, barbecue, pork, lemongrass, chicken, the cold cuts, things like that. We just have to keep it in-house or else how are we going to expand these offerings or these brands within the umbrella of our brand, Tea & Milk? And that's the reason why Bay Ridge was born. It was to create that centralized kitchen along with the seating for what we wanted from the very beginning.
And now, is that location the only place that you can get sandwiches and then just bubble tea at the other ones, or you're doing your sandwiches everywhere?
We're doing our sandwiches in Astoria and Bay Ridge at the moment. It's funny because before this meeting, we were just talking to Joanne from Pearl River Mart, which is the president of Pearl River Mart and Pearl River Mart Foods, which is where we're at. We're inside Chelsea Market, inside Pearl River Mart Foods. We just had a conversation and basically a meeting about bringing the sandwiches to another location, which is right next door to the Tea & Milk location in Chelsea Market, and just basically having the Vietnamese sandwiches there starting in April.
Amazing. That's so cool. Good for you.
Yeah. It's something that we wanted to do. We wanted to do this like a while back, but then it's just since the opening and the whole, since from July till now, there was just a lot of stress. Because Bay Ridge was such a, how do I say this in a way where it's not too crazy? Bay Ridge was hard during the times from its grand open to even till now. It's still just as hard. But the increase of foot traffic has helped a lot. So the stress of that is diminished a little bit. But during that time, we were just finalizing how the kitchen should be working, how we deliver, who delivers, what days our cooks will come in to basically get things ready for delivery on the next day. Just all these procedures and protocols that we had to put in place that we've never put in place before. It took us 4 months to do it. And on top of that, there was a lot of other financial stress too, which is probably part of the reason why it took a little longer than we expected it to.
I'm curious how you personally navigate all that procedural stuff. I've been coaching a handful of entrepreneurs the past year, like through Yelp, we're doing these little programs. And one of the biggest things that I try to teach them that I think helps is to break the stuff down to smaller tasks. Sometimes the task of let's get the chef's schedule together, it's like that is such a behemoth of a thing that you don't ever want to do it. But what if we do one step that's a part of getting the general schedule together? Is that how you do it? How do you push yourself through these really big projects that require a lot of small steps and systems? You're building a lot of systems, which takes time because you have to think of how you want it, try it, and then adjust as you see how it goes.
The way I do it would be to schedule these things into my daily routine, things like that. You just have to put them into your calendar. If you don't, you're going to forget. I'm very forgetful, so if I don't put them in my calendar, I'm going to forget. I think that goes for a lot of people. And the second thing is breaking it down into smaller pieces helps a lot, like you said. What I do sometimes is that I break them down into pieces where you were like it's microscopic, where you basically have to think about the procedures and protocols, what you need to set in place, but at the same time, think about all the problems and all the situations that can arise before even putting those things in place. Those things have to be done. I'll give you an example, delivery. We do deliveries on Wednesdays and Saturdays. And from there, we have to figure out, okay, the cook's schedule. When do they come in? Obviously, before Wednesday and Saturday. It has to be the day before. But then the teams who need the foods and the ingredients to make the sandwiches, to make the bubble tea, when do they need to tell the team, the cooks? And that has to be the day before cooks go in. And then that has to be the day before and someone will deliver it the next day, because that's when all the stuff is done. Then you run into the problem of, what if someone gets sick? What if the car has a flat tire? What if you purchased a car that just basically is so old and there's problems, oil leak, engine problems, things like that, right? All these things, you just gotta pretend that they're there. All these problems are all there. And you just have to have a protocol set in place to basically, what's the next step? What happens if that happens? Who does this? Who does that? Who goes in and cooks? Who goes in and does a delivery? If the cook is sick, who is going to come in and just make sure that all the items that needs to be cooked are there? It's all these predetermining the problems that aren't there yet and basically going from there. That's how my mind works. And then obviously we all wish and hope that none of that happens. That's basically it. Like we don't want it to happen. But when it does, you need to have those protocols in place. And you just have to imagine those things first.
I want to talk about feedback. You know, that's a big part of this show, but that's also just a big part of how you've navigated your business. You hypothesize about what the customers might want and use your own experience, but you've really always been listening to what customers say. Can you talk about how you navigate that, how you maybe gather or ask for feedback? Just talk to me about feedback as a part of this process. And I think research is probably a follow-up to that. I do want to talk about how you went to literally dig further into matcha and figure out what you were going to do there. Because even as you're telling me all these stressful, crazy things, you had to be there, blah, 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 you still took time to fly across the ocean and dig into something that's going to help you in the long run. And I know that's because you're committed to feedback and research. So just talk me through that and how that's a part of your business.
A big part of the reason why I went to Japan is because we went to Yuji and then Kyoto. And that's basically the most popular place for matcha. And we basically traveled to different fields and different brands of matcha and learned about different types of matcha, the way the shade, each tea leaf, they have to have a certain amount of time in the shade to make it. It was explained to us in a way where basically is that like different type of matcha, they have different ways of getting it done, processing it. And one of which was to put this black tarp on top. And it's to block the sun from hitting the tea leaves, which is Camellia sinensis. Tea just comes from the same plant, right? Camellia sinensis. There's every single tea. And the matcha one is just the leaf itself grounded up versus other teas that are cooked, baked, steamed into what it is. And then that's when you brew it. That's when you brew the tea. Matcha, you're drinking the tea leaf itself. We went to different farms, different locations in UG, and there isn't a lot of tourists there. We had to find different guides who actually knew these farms to bring us there. A lot of tourists now, they go to UG, but then they go to the basic area. What we did was we went over there and we went to the farms, the manufacturing. So we learned a little bit more than what the average tourist would probably learn. Not to say that's a bad thing, right? Everyone should enjoy the time. I enjoy my time there too as a tourist. And the biggest part of it is that we learned that back then they used to grind ground up matcha by stone. And that took a long time. Some places still do it. And the reason is because it's ceremonial grade. And that is the reason why certain matcha costs so much money. It's very different when I was there. It was very zen. It gave me a learning experience that I didn't think I was going to get, but it helped me learn a little bit more about the Japanese culture and the making of matcha versus just drinking it. So that I want to bring and educate and bring back to the States to educate. I also did a tea ceremony as well. And every single little part of making the matcha tea in itself, it's to be celebrated, whether it be pouring hot water from the hot water canister to the cup or the little bowl where the matcha is being whisked. Every single part of that is ceremony. It's to celebrate. It's to bring together. It's very interesting. It's very zen. It's very together. If you feel very together with the culture in itself. So that's something that we learned in Japan, and it was an amazing experience.
I think you were talking in incredible bits about doing the research, and it actually led me to a different question, which is about feedback. That was what I originally was thinking, but you led me into it in a different way, which is something we talked about in the first episode. Because you serve something that maybe a lot of people are trying for the first time, or because it is supposed to be made a certain way with certain ingredients, but people just don't like that, even though it could be accurate the way it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. You deal with a little more of that because you sell food items and beverages that people aren't always fully familiar with. Mm-hmm. Can you just talk about how you navigate that? Like, sometimes what they don't like is how it's supposed to be. So mm-hmm. how do you mix education about what you're serving with kind of just navigating some of that feedback that's so subjective and they don't understand how it's supposed to taste?
Mm-hmm. I think in the very beginning, we were using, let's just say even like the matcha scenario, right? We were using matcha in the very beginning of tea and milk and our Astoria storefront. We were using even close to ceremonial grade matcha in the very beginning, and people didn't like it. People were not too open to it. And the reason is because it had that strong taste to it. It wasn't familiar and it was something that was different. So from there, we learned that people's taste vary from point A to point B and even from aging as well. So what we did was we had to transition out of that grade of matcha into something different, to kind of then re-educate everyone to understand what the difference is. In the beginning, we had to give maybe, let's see, two types of matcha. One was a lower grade. Not to say it's bad, it's worse, but it's not top tier on the matcha scale. So we had to use that to re-educate and educate them and basically to have them understand what the taste difference is. And from there, people started to learn more about the premium grades of matcha, tasted it and liked it. But you're going to get the people who are not going to like that premium taste of matcha. And don't get me wrong, I totally understand. And I sympathize with that as well, because, hey, you know, what you're used to isn't what you paid for. Sometimes it's like, hey, like, I don't really like this. But the thing is that if it's feedback wise, you have to take it, and then you just have to adjust from there. We adjusted throughout all these years. We improved. No matter what, every year, I would say our drinks have improved since day one, even though the recipe is the same. We've improved on maybe lowering the simple syrup that goes in there into each drink. We improved in maybe cooking the boba a little longer, letting it sit for a little longer, just so it has a better texture to it. There are so many ways to improve, and because of listening to other people's feedback. So that's one example of the whole feedback situation, learning and basically what it's supposed to taste versus what people are used to. Another one would be the taro. The taro is such a thing because the purple powder is the one that people are used to. And then what we put in is the real taro root. And to this day, I mean, we still have people who are like, oh, it's not purple. It tastes different. It doesn't taste the same. And then they'll want a different drink, or they'll tell me that it tastes so much better. You have the polar opposites. Right? It's not always in the middle where like, oh, it's okay. But it's the polar opposite of it tastes amazing versus can I get a different drink? And we understand. So although we're trying to drive to a more natural state of what bubble tea should be, we're going to change that drink for you. We're not going to let you leave unhappy either. That's not how we want to do things. We want you to be happy with the brand, and we want you to trust the brand. So ordering something that you didn't like, you get something else that you like, and then you build that trust with that person. And then eventually, maybe they'll try it again, and then you re-educate, and you keep going with the education. It's continuous. We all learn as entrepreneurs that we have to learn continuously. Other people have to do the same thing. They have to learn continuously too. And you have to educate them. Someone has to educate them. And if it's not you, who else is going to do it?
We have talked about so much good stuff. I think my last question is just about responsiveness. And you sort of talked about it there. If someone is in the shop and they try something, like you're right there trying to gauge if they like it, if we need to fix it. But you're also responsive all over the place, responding to reviews, responsive on social. Can you talk about why that's important and also how you're able to prioritize it with all the other things you have going on?
On the reviews and things like that, on like DMs, on social media or reviews or just things that are throughout the whole day, there's so much more to do. But at the same time, your customers' reviews are very important to you. It should be very important to you, even though sometimes you may not want to read it because it's a bad review or something like that. There's always going to be your bad reviews, really good reviews, or some average reviews. And I think in the end of the day, even though, I mean, I've been doing this for a decade now, over a decade, and it still hits me whenever there's a negative-ish review or like a 2-star, 3-star review. And then you read it and you're just like, oh man, what are we doing wrong? How can we improve? And then that helps you with improving. It doesn't mean your product is wrong, right? It could be very well like something went wrong during the assembly process. There's so many other things that you have to then figure out. But if it's one or two reviews out of so many and it's not continuous, then maybe it's just one off, two off type of thing. But if it's something that's continuously 1-star, 2-star throughout the whole month worth of like reviews are like that, then there's a big possibility that there's something is wrong and you really have to take a look at it. I mean, it shouldn't take a whole month for you to see that. You should definitely see it on a weekly basis or so. Because if you take a whole month, then, you know, it might be too late, as they say. Yeah. But I think you have to respond to the reviews. It shows that you care as the business owner. I think you definitely have to respond in a timely fashion. But I suggest not on the same day that you read it. Cool down if it's a negative thing. And if it's a positive thing, cool down as well. Just say what you want to say. But at the same time, just remember, once it's out there, there's really no going back. People take screenshots all the time. So do your best to just, if it's a negative review, just calm down, get a little headed first, and then go and respond. At the same time, If it's a positive review, like I said, just same thing. Get excited, but don't get too excited because who knows what the next one is going to be.
There's been so much great information for other business owners in this conversation, but is there something you want to talk about that we didn't get a chance to dig into yet? Maybe something about the recent expansion in Bay Ridge?
A big part of it is that Bay Ridge, we built it out with so much money, and right now we're obviously still operating at a loss because of the build out and things like that. But it's all about the investment. And at the same time, like with the numbers, I'm the numbers person too, sometimes, like a good amount of the times. It's just that we want to speak about supporting local. I think that's one thing that people definitely should do, because I get it, right? Let's just cafe wise, right? You get your Blue Bottle, your Starbucks, your La Colombe, things like that. And then you have Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, things like that, who are big conglomerates. And sometimes they don't really care about the neighborhood as much as one may say. And I think that supporting your local small businesses versus, I would say, like a big conglomerate like that is very important, because one day you'll go to a cafe or go to a small local hardware store and things like that, and then you don't go to them anymore. But and then you go to Home Depot or you go to Starbucks, you go to Blue Bottle, and then maybe 2 months, 3 months, or even half a year or a year down the line, you're just like, hey, I remember going to this place and they were so nice, blah, 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 but I kind of forgot about them. And you go back and then you see a for rent sign or an empty space. I mean, it sucks. It sucks for the small business, but it also sucks because now you on your end, maybe it's not you that didn't support them enough, but it's more like everyone just forgets about the small businesses versus the big conglomerates. And which is why we go into neighborhoods. We go into neighborhoods that we believe who are starving for a certain type of brands. And we go in there because we saw Bay Ridge. We saw what it was lacking, and we wanted to go in there to be the brand that can offer something different. We don't expect the support, but we would like the support. I think in all small businesses, they would like the support that they put their company in or their brand in. And if locals don't support them, the next person, the next company that comes in could be just another Starbucks or another big conglomerate that's just going to really not care about the local community. They're just there for the money. A big part of it is like a lot of these small businesses all depend on local businesses. They don't really depend on people who are three boroughs away or the next state away. They depend on those who are in the community. So I think that's a big part of what small businesses are like, and small brands are like. They want the locals to support them.
Yeah, and supporting is everything from spending your money there to writing a review to even just sharing your experience on social. And I think sometimes customers forget that. You might not be able to go to a place every single week, but how can you spread the word when you do go? And I like your point about being intentional. If you map out supporting small businesses and swap that in for other things that you might be mindlessly doing, a small business or a big business, you can spend your money the way you want to, but it does take a little bit of thinking. I want a coffee. What's the small business that I can go support? And I think it's so important to call that out for customers and remind them that that's an investment in themselves and their community too. Just like you said, they want those places to be around, but then they need to be action forward about supporting them.
Absolutely. I'd say locals need to be active on the local places that they like. It doesn't have to be, spending money there every day. It could be writing a review. It could be just like word of mouth, telling your friends, talk about the business, the place that you went to the other day, and like, oh yeah, it was delicious, things like that. Or this hardware store, the guy helped me out so much. He was just so into it, to helping out, and things like that. It's not literally all about the money part. Granted, right, a lot of small businesses are, their margins aren't high. So supporting them with spending is great if you need it or if you want to. But the other part of supporting is the getting the word out there to your friends, to your family, to locals, neighbors, things like that. That's a very important thing. If you want the business to stay, you have to help support in a way.
And that concludes our episode. I hope you enjoyed it and were able to take a thing or two away to implement in your own life. Whether it's a new idea that you can bring back to your business or a fresh perspective on how to be a positive influence as a consumer, we share these stories to inspire and create more meaningful connections in your local community. This episode featured a conversation with Matthew Wong, one of the owners of Tea and Milk. Special thanks to Holly Hanchy, who helped edit this episode. To learn more about the story, head to yelp.com/behindthereview. And check out the guest details and episode takeaways. And don't forget to subscribe to the show on your favorite listening platform so you get an alert each Thursday that we drop a new episode. To claim your own Yelp business page and start engaging with consumers, visit business.yelp.com. Our theme song is performed by Ali Schwartz and produced by Robbie G of Messerol Sound.